The actor Orla Brady has performed in hit TV shows like Mistresses, Nip Tuck and American Horror Story, to name but a few. She's just finished filming the second season of the Star Trek spin-off Picard alongside Patrick Stewart. That'll be released next year. And on Friday, her latest feature film, Rose Plays Julie, opens in Irish cinemas. It's written and directed by Joe Lawler and Christine Malloy and tells the story of Rose, an adopted young woman coming to terms with the circumstances of her birth. The film also stars Anne Skelly and Aidan Gillen. Orla Brady plays Rose's birth mother, Ellen, who has gone on to have a family and a successful career as an actor in London, far away from the trauma of what she went through at home in Ireland. Absolutely delighted to be joined on Arena this evening by Orla Brady on the line from London. Great to talk with you, Orla.
And it's really, really lovely to be here. I'm delighted to join you, Sean.
This film, I believe, Rose Plays Julie, which is deeply moving, wonderful watch, I have to say. You knew, I think, from pretty much the minute you read the script, Orla, that this was something you wanted to do.
I did. I remember sitting at a table in my house, having printed out this script, and I closed it and I thought, God, if I have any say in this, because I knew they were seeing a few people for the role, I thought, I really have to do this if I can convince them to take me on. It the script felt like something very, very considered, very true. I mean, I subsequently found out that they had spent years. They began with this idea and the writing of it in 2014, I believe. So they had developed and redeveloped and got to a place where you sort of felt that there was a ballast underneath it. The characters felt true. And, you know, there are scripts where you can read a punchy narrative or whatever, but it's more surface. This felt like it had a depth and a trueness to it that caught me.
Yeah, and I would have been presumed, like a lot of people, well, sure, when Orla Brady gets a script, she's given the script and asked, do you want to play this part or not? Not the other way around.
But go ahead. You know, the good jobs. No, there was some, but if, to be honest with you, I think a lot of people, quite rightly now, a lot of directors, producers, they want to feel out what your sensibility would be with a given script. So I'm sure there are big stars who get offered things all the time, and you know, I would get offered some things, but there's a lot of, you know, having to try for things. Yeah.
Does it put a pressure on you then, you know, when you went into the room, and I presume the media, or probably Zoom, given the period that we're talking about, possibly, Joe Lawler and Christine Malloy, although this was all pre-COVID, does it put pressure on you, even with your experience and the big hit TV shows that you've been part of, going into a room and kind of saying, I really want this part, you know, because you know that thing, if you're too desperate, it can be a problem as well.
Well, yes, but it didn't feel like that. I didn't feel nervous. I just felt that I, and you know, I hope I'm right about this, but I felt I understood who this woman was, her story, where she came from. I felt very clear that I knew what to do with it, and if they trusted me with their role, with their script, that, you know, I was their girl, if you like. So it's not that I was... It's not that I would never put anybody on the spot saying, you have to give me this role. It's more that I wanted to hopefully communicate that to them, that I felt I could take care of it for them.
It's that thing of what you wanted to serve the role, you wanted to serve the script. So what was it? Tell us a little bit about Ellen then, who she is and what her circumstances were and why it spoke so much to you.
Well, Ellen is somebody who, I think what they had written is they've sort of, consciously or unconsciously at the time, they've tapped into something that has we are now having a conversation about as a country, which is the attitude, if you like, towards women, towards sexual assault and rape. They had created a character who had experienced sexual assault, but as one did in the day, I mean, certainly my generation, hopefully this is no longer as much the case, but my generation of women, you buried it. You absolutely sort of just put it behind you. You assumed that somehow you had made a misstep, somehow it was your mistake and your fault that something had happened. And so you felt a shame and embarrassment, and you just put it away, didn't speak about it, maybe talk to a few friends, but you certainly didn't make a complaint, as I hope people feel that they have the right to do now. And this is something that I very much felt had to be explored dramatically and talked about. And there it was in the script.
And then when the character of Rose, who is the daughter or who is the child that was conceived in these violent circumstances, when she appears on Ellen's doorstep, Ellen, very successful in her career, family of her own and a very successful actor. We see her on set, in fact, a couple of times, you know, in parts that she's playing. When that arrives at the door, at Ellen's door, the trauma and the memories that that brings up must be enormous.
Yes, I think that what she had done is reasonably successfully cut off a part of herself in order to not acknowledge what had happened to her. She had sort of buried it in a part of herself and had gone on to a very determined, successful life. Certain brittleness within that, because in order to do that, you damage yourself by not acknowledging your whole history, what has happened to you. So this you know, this child, this young woman appears, and with all her courage and grit and her determination to find out who she is, to explore her identity, she perseveres and she confronts Ellen with the fact of herself and the fact that they are mother and daughter, and won't go away, even though Ellen at the beginning really tries to reject her. I mean, in a way that I found a little bit shocking when I read first, I thought, my goodness, how could any mother do this? But of course, if you're not ready for it, if you have, as she did, if you have reacted a certain way, you might not want to. So I think, you know, the filmmakers have called this a love story between mother and daughter, an unusual love story. And in a sense it is, in a sense that determination of Rose's is what allows Ellen to become whole again.
Let's listen to a scene quite early on. In fact, this is their first conversation, their first face-to-face meeting and conversation. Actor Anna Skelly playing Rose, and you obviously as Ellen, you drive into the forest, and it's the first chance they have really to speak to each other properly.
When I need to be on my own, get away from things, this is where I come. Do you like walking?
Not particularly.
Walking's good for you. It's good for stress. It calms you down. That's the theory, at least.
I should take it up, then.
Can I ask you something?
Okay.
Eva, did you say anything to her?
No.
Because she knows nothing about you. Nobody does.
Listen. It's a nightingale.
A scene there from Rose plays Julie, and we had Anne Skelly as Rose and the character of Ellen played by Orla Brady, who's speaking with me this evening on the programme. You know, Orla, you talked about that the filmmakers here, Joe Lawler and Christine Molloy, talked about this being a love story between a daughter and a mother and a daughter. We always talk about, when we hear love stories, oh, what's the chemistry like between the two main characters here? This is a different type of chemistry that I guess you had to be found between yourself and Anne Skelly. Can you legislate for that? Or did, when you met Anne and when the two of you spoke, was it just there? Did you have to work on it?
No, it was there. And a lot of that is down to Anne Skelly. She really is a fabulous actress. I mean, she is described as fast rising. I believe she's going to rise all the way to great things. I mean, she's wonderful. An unusual actress, I think. She works in a similar way to I do. We asked for a lot of quiet on the set because of the subject matter. And we would both settle into scenes very quietly. I mean, we'd have a bit of crack outside the scenes, you know, and during the day. But when we were actually in the takes, in the shooting, we would both just sort of nestle down into it, if you like. And I felt I didn't have to do very much. I didn't have to perform. That was very much what the filmmakers wanted. They encouraged us to be rather than perform these scenes. And with another actor, that might have been difficult because you would be trying to act what wasn't necessarily fully there. But with Anne, I could just look at her little face and, oh my God, it was all there. It's, she really is quite special.
Yeah, I suppose people might know her here at home from Red Rock, the what was then the TV3 Virgin Media series, and also Death and Nightingales, the BBC adaptation of the Eugene McCabe book. And as you say, she has this very easy screen presence, a very unusual screen presence, and that chemistry is there between the two of you. You're talking there about the, you know, the type of quiet on set, and obviously this was a relatively small project, I'm guessing, in comparison to some of the things that, you know, we can talk about in terms of Mistress's Nip Tuck, American Horror Story, and indeed probably mostly Star Trek, Picard, the latest manifestation. Very different atmosphere on those big sets, I would have thought.
Oh my God, it's like being in the middle of a party some days. I mean, it's... Yeah, I just wrapped on Star Trek there last week and it was lovely. I mean, a wonderful thing to do. And, you know, and as I keep saying, I got pointy ears, which is, you know, just
always a plus. You know,
definitely the peak of my career. I loved it. A huge set, hundreds of people. And you're going into takes and there's a lot of noise and a lot of shouting, a lot of equipment, a lot of, you know, cherry pickers and three cameras. And it's, yeah, it's a big, big machine and you're in the middle of it and you have to find your own little space, you know, within that. For the subject matter in this film, it's, I remember during the rehearsal, we asked, I at one stage said, because I had the gorgeous experience of working with Martin Campbell a few years earlier on a film called The Foreigner. And he very much made it a thing that during the takes, just during the takes, I mean, there's only a certain proportion of any filming day when you're actually in takes. And the rest of it, you're setting up, you're doing this and that, you're lighting. But he just said, during the takes, I want absolute silence. And he meant it. He said, this is the time for the actors. This is the time to let this happen. So when we were in rehearsal, I just said certain takes, if we could have that. And then Anne added to that, which I loved her for. She said, actually, could we just have silence during the takes throughout the film? And we never had to ask again. It just happened. It was a lovely, lovely crew. I think it was very much put in place by the filmmakers again. They saw the need for that and it helped. So, yeah, it was a very different experience. Yeah. Same job. Different quality.
The silence in this clip that I want to play from Rose Plays Julie really struck me. It's the scene at this stage Ellen has taken apart at home in Ireland, basically to get a chance to get closer to Rose. And there's a picture that she spots in their apartment. But what I really noted in this scene in particular is the silence that's all around the two of you.
It's odd to be back after all these years. I never thought I would come back.
Why did you?
I came back because of you. Is that you?
Yeah. That photo was actually taken the day my parents told me I was adopted. We went for a walk to the lighthouse afterwards. My mom, she wanted to take a picture of me. She asked me to turn around, but I wouldn't. I don't know why. But I couldn't. She passed away 2 years ago.
What was her name?
Patsy.
Patsy.
I think you two would have gotten on really well.
Anne Skelly and Aura Brady there in a scene from Rose Plays Julie. That silence, it is extraordinary in that, Aura Brady. It really is.
The silence, you mean? The, yeah. I think there was... again, it was something that Joe and Christine encouraged very much, is just letting things have their time.
Yeah.
And let them roll out, as conversations often do, where people don't know what to say quite. And it isn't conversational in the sense that scripts often are, where it's rat-a-tat. They just wanted us to sit and be in this, because they, at that moment in the film, these two women are unsure how they relate to each other and how it's going to be.
This film was actually shot before COVID, so you didn't have to worry about distancing and all those things. We didn't have any of that vocabulary, social distancing, etc., and sanitizing our hands to the extent that we now have those things as kind of natural behaviour. Coming back to it after all that period, what was that feeling like? Again, particularly since you were coming off the set of Picard, to come back to this film to do all the launching of it.
It's, you know, look, it is funny because, like I said, I took off pointy ears a few days ago with all the kerfuffle of that. But very easy in one way. And that's because I really love this film. I'm very proud of it. I hope it gets an outing. And if anything, you know, the pandemic year felt like a pause. It doesn't feel that long ago, even though it was 2 years ago and it was due to go out exactly as the pandemic happened. I think we were all at the Dublin Film Festival with it when everything kicked off, and it was due to go out a few weeks later, and then, you know, the rest.
Yeah.
So in a sense, it feels like it was 5 minutes ago. You know, I'm getting back to, it's you know, it's a conversation with an old friend. You get on the phone after a year and you're fine.
You're back there. And did you spend most of lockdown then in Dublin? Or were you obviously,
Picard,
was the second season of Picard was shot. What was the state of play with COVID there?
Well, what happened is essentially I was about to go back from the Dublin Film Festival when everything kicked off. So I stayed in Ireland, you know, to be with my mum for a while and spent several months, probably, God, ages actually that year with my mum. And then during that time they asked me to join the cast. I guested in season one, and then they asked me to join the cast in season two. And that was wonderful because it kind of brought me through the anxiety of that time, because, as you know, as we're keenly aware, many people were losing their businesses or, you know, being unsure whether work would happen in the same way again. And I had this job which just sustained me through the whole thing. Now, I did have to wait a long time for it because they kept wanting to go, and CBS were holding off until they had all the protocols in place.
Yeah.
So we ended up having to wait until, I think it was February or March to begin season two. So there was a long wait period, and then we went into the actual shoot with the masks and the sanitizer and, you know.
Masks that had to go over pointy ears, it has to be said as well.
Well, special, I wasn't allowed, actually. Well, I did have to have, once the pointy ears were on, you weren't allowed to touch them. So we had all these arrangements, just me clamping my mask on with my hand, because you're only supposed to have the mask off when you're actually shooting. Look, I was mainly working with Patrick, and we were both very relaxed with each other, and
that worked fine. And you're a full cast member now, because you had been in season one as a kind of as a guest, a character who came in for two episodes, which I think then grew to three, and now you're a full cast member. And you have been to Comic-Con against all the advice. Why did you go, and why is all this advice to not go?
Well, now, in fairness, I think I may have been unclear about that. I went to Comic-Con a few years ago.
Oh, before all of this, right.
Yeah, no, it wasn't for Star Trek. It was for a different show. And I guess I was just making the comment that I rather love the sort of slightly nerdy fan base of a lot of sci-fi shows. I just discovered... it's my inner nerdy sci-fi person. There you go. Has somehow, you know, I just like it. I just felt it was a rather wonderfully direct way to interact with fans, and the fans of these shows are just lovely. So
will you take Laris and her pointy ears to a Comic-Con sometime soon, do you think?
I don't think she'd be going in pointy ears. I don't think that's how it goes down. But you can, I sort of can't imagine myself doing that somehow. That's all in the future with Star Trek. It doesn't come out till next year. Mm. I don't know what they have planned for publicity, and as and when I will see. I doubt I'll be wandering around with pointy ears anywhere. But she is a character I love very much, and more to the point, I got to work closely most of my scenes with Patrick Stewart, and he's just heaven to work with. You know, he's very, very engaged in everything he does, and he's a legend for a reason. So I've had two in a row. I've had Patrick to do scenes with, which is wonderful, and I've had, previous to that, I've had Anne Skelly to do scenes with, and Aidan Gillen, indeed.
Yes, of course.
All of these were just wonderful experiences. So right now, as an actor, I've had, you know, just a treat of a time to get to work with these people.
You've earned your spurs, I think, at this stage. It's lovely to speak with you. Thanks so much for joining us on the programme this evening.
Such a pleasure to join you, Sean. Thank you so much for asking me on.
Not at all. That's Orla Brady there, and talking to us about the film Rose Plays Julie, which is in Irish cinemas this weekend. We will be reviewing it on tomorrow night's Arena. Autumn telly back with a bang this week. Last Sunday, we saw the first episode of Kin, RTE's new drama series centred around the Dublin-based Kinsella family embroiled in a gangland war. Stars Aidan Gillen, who we've just been talking about in the previous film as well. Ciarán Hinds is in there, Claire Dunn and Maria Doyle Kennedy. This Thursday, Channel 4 will air their drama set in a fictional Liverpool care home in spring 2020. This is called Help. Carer, played by Jodie Comer, who bonds with a patient played by Stephen Graham, put to the test in horrific circumstances as the COVID-19 pandemic hits. And Apple TV sees the return of its hit series, The Morning Show. Season 1 finished in explosive fashion back in 2019. The new season, initially delayed, then rewritten because of COVID-19, is back. Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon very much at the helm in that particular series. Jen Gannon has been busy watching all three, and she's with me now. Let's start with Kin. We've only had episode one, obviously. It's aired on Sunday night on RTE1. You know, once you hear Gangland War, once you hear that it's got to do with drugs, drug dealing, and that you're in Dublin, the media say, oh, that's love-hate, isn't it?
It is, like, and that's very hard. I was thinking, you know, are we ever going to move out from under the shadow of Nige? Like, he is just this indelible character within Irish TV that it's difficult to get him out of our minds or love-hate out of your mind when you're watching Kin. But Kin, I mean, love-hate may have given it its lexicon and its attitude, but I think Kin is quite a different beast in a way.
It struck me at an initial look, even. You know,
it's beautifully shot.
Really stylish.
Yeah, the cinematography is just wonderful, and I think Dublin looks amazing with the shadow of the Aviva. And I was saying it's a bit of a weird location thing because those houses are not that big inside. I promise you that, like down in Stella Gardens, if anyone's listening, I know what they look like. But it is beautiful. They look like something, you know, out of Grand Designs or something, even like.
Because this Kinsella family are very wealthy.
They are, yeah. And it's a lot about that moneyed sense of crime. And that's an interesting part of the story, I think. And that's why I'd be more interested in digging into the more domestic side of things. I think when you move away from your strict cops and robbers style drama, and I think if they go down that route and just concentrate on that, they'll miss out on... When you talk about what made The Sopranos great, what made it great is because it actually valued and balanced the crime and violence out with the domestic and what made these people tick and giving them some kind of drawing them as three-dimensional characters. These people that you think are without empathy, kind of giving them a little bit of humanity even, and making the viewer kind of judge where they stand with them or in supporting them or admiring them or, you know, how they feel about that. And I think that's what Kin should really do. And if it wants to do that, I think it has really strong female actresses who are ready to take on those roles with relish, I think. And I'd love to see them do more, like Claire Dunn, her character, who is basically embroiled in money laundering for the family when she runs this kind of shell company of a car. It's a car.
High-end car sales. That's how they launder the money.
And I'd love to see her do more. I hope she's not reduced to just some kind of gangster's mall type. I'd rather, if they dig into her character and her psychology, she's all about trying to get her son, you know, mobile into college and be respectable. And that's what her character is kind of about in the first episode. And you also have Maria Doyle Kennedy, who I think is just great. And she really didn't spend the first episode doing a lot except for talking about food and moving back and forwards to the fridge. She was a bit like a glorified super value ad. So they really need to do more with her.
Yeah, well, I wondered though how much, you know, what hidden powers are going to suddenly arise, particularly out of an actor like Maria Doyle
Kennedy. I hope there's a Lady Macbeth vibe with this. Yeah, definitely. If she's pulling strings behind the scenes, I would hope so.
Yeah. So that aspect, you want more of those characters to be developed. Ciarán Hinds and Aidan Gillen, you know, those are the guys you want at the head of.
Ciarán Hinds is very briefly in it. He was only in two scenes. So I'm we know that his character plays a major role in it. So he's the other side of things. He plays Eamon Cunningham. So he's the other big
drug
boss. Yeah, that is swooping in on the Kinslas and trying to get them to work with him. And, you know, those just even having one scene between Aidan Gillen and him to start the show off showed promise. So we want more of that. Yeah. He has this very coolly menacing vibe.
We listened to that opening scene, actually, or it's very early on. And they're in an amazing
venue,
location. Yeah, very high up, looking all over Dublin. High class drinks and food and everything around them. Anything you could want, in fact, present. And Aidan Gillen and playing the character of Frank, and Ciarán Hinds playing the character of Eamon.
You want something to drink?
No, grand. Thanks, Tom.
Get him a whiskey.
Con. Meat. Thanks.
Con says you've been having some grief.
Yeah. One of your lads, Quaylon Moore, has been encroaching.
He's young. Enthusiastic. You remember what that was like?
Well, he burnt out two of our dealers. They can't have that, Eamon.
Look, Quaylon gets all his product from me. He's not using other suppliers. Not like you do. I have to repay loyalty with loyalty.
You and I have been doing business since before Moore was born, and no one shifts as much product for you as we do.
It's not personal, Frank. Just the model's changing. You're either all in with me or you're not.
Of course it's not personal.
Never is.
Ciarán Hinds, it's only business. Ciarán Hinds as Eamon Cunningham there, and Aidan Gillen as Frank, who's the leader of the Kinsella clan, really, in terms of where Kin is going. Jen Gannon looking at that first episode first. Just before we move off, you want more from them, you want more from Maria Doyle Kennedy and Claire Dunne, but Charlie Cox, we have to give him a mention.
He's amazing.
English
for an
actor.
English actor who people would know from Daredevil. I think he's been watching a lot of Brendan Gleeson, because I think that's where the accent is coming from, and we could have another Daisy Edgar-Jones on our hands in the way that he's perfected a notoriously difficult accent.
And he's a character that's just getting out of jail. And
they're trying to pull him back into the family business.
So that's kind of where the drama is going to arise. Episode 2 is next Sunday, but episode 1 is up on the RTE player. So if you missed it on Sunday, it's worth it. First episodes are notoriously difficult.
They're difficult.
A lot of stuff to set up.
There's a lot of introductory faff that they have to get out of the way, and that the meat of the episode, the meat will take place next episode, I think. And really, you need to catch up on episode 1. There's a lot of spoilers out there right now, headlines and everything. So
watch it quick and work out the family relationship.
The family tree.
Have to work that one out for yourself. Let's move on then to Channel 4's drama Help. I watched some of this today. It is a very difficult watch. Just talk about the team behind it, and I think that'll give us a sense of the kind of area that we're in terms of style.
This is basically a social drama ripped straight from the headlines, and it's another collaboration between the BAFTA winning writer Jack Thorne, who's worked with Shane Meadows on things like The Virtues and This Is England, the series 86 and 90, and the very highly stylized work of director Mark Munden, who has done this really unique, visually striking work with Jack Thorne for programmes like National Treasure with Robbie Coltrane and the brilliant original Utopia that was on Channel 4, and his the look of his work is very unique, and they've worked together. They collaborated on National Treasure together, and this is another one that they're taking on.
And so, when you hear Jodie Comer in the midst of all of that, I mean, when I think of Jodie Comer, I'm going to think of Killing Eve, which is,
of course,
now she's hugely versatile in how she played that role, but again, that was kind of a high end, quite a stylish type of drama. This is a whole different ball game.
She basically, her and Stephen Graham, who we know from The Virtues as well, and This Is England, they both wanted to work together. They're both from Liverpool. They wanted to do a story that's centred in Liverpool. They approached Jack Thorne and said, "We want you to write something for us." He was going back into Liverpool history, couldn't find anything appropriate, but then when it started to like formulate a story about a care home, and then the pandemic struck and he changed the story completely. He was avoiding talking about what was going on in care homes at the time. And then he took the story to a friend and he said, no, you have to talk about exactly what's going on at the moment.
Well, give us, I suppose, which gives us a sense of where the story started with Stephen Graham's character and his, it's young onset Alzheimer's that he has, isn't it?
He's 47 and basically Jodie Comer plays Sarah and she comes from a pretty unhappy background. She is has an alcoholic father. They're struggling. She's jumping from job to job, really unsatisfying jobs. And they're going, you know, there's that shame of poverty hanging around the family. They're living sometimes off food from food banks, and she lands a job in a care home and, you know, ends up finding her calling really in this care home. And
because Stephen Graham is there because his family, his mother has died.
His mother has died and he ends up moving into the care home, and she really strikes up this great relationship with him. They have this great chemistry together, and
It's there in this, almost, it's not quite the first scene that they have together. The first scene that they have together is absolutely beautiful. Let people watch it and see it for themselves. But this is, Stephen Graham's character has gone wandering. He's gone home because
he always tries to go back to his mother's house and then realises that it finally dawns on him that she's died.
Well, you will get a sense of that in this scene. And the other voice, we'll hear Jodie Comer, we'll hear Stephen Graham, we'll also hear the voice of Ian Hart, who's the manager of the care home, who's trying to persuade Stephen Graham's character to come back as well.
You just confused me.
What? Do you want to go?
Come on, it's only Steve.
I was expecting a bigger lawyer. And this is what you do? One and a half sugars.
I get back to me, Ma. She needs me. She worries about me when I'm not there.
Why were you a naughty boy at school, was
she? Sometimes, yeah.
Oh, she had the right to worry then, didn't she?
Do you want to come back to ours? Your mum makes the best scouse in the world.
Oh, I love scouse. Especially with a load of HP. Can you tell me a recipe?
Oh, she's out of day. She is dead, isn't she? I forgot my mum was dead.
We're going to take you home, Tony.
I'm going home.
Somebody else lives there now, Tony. The council, they've given that to someone else.
You have a bed in a home with us, Bright Sky Homes. Do you remember? Bright Sky?
Jodie Comer, Stephen Graham and Ian Hart in a scene there from Help, Channel 4 drama, which is showing tomorrow night, one of three that Jen Gannon has been looking at for us. Stephen Graham, he says he can get so much emotion. Now, obviously, that's an emotional scene, but he gets emotion into everything he does. I won't find myself welling up the minute I see him on screen.
He is astonishing. He is such a very intense actor, but also a very empathetic actor. And I think that's the way him and Jodie Comer work off each other in this.
And it's not a Jodie Comer I've seen before.
No, she's extraordinary in it. She really is. She gives everything to the role of those girls that you may pass by. They may work on a checkout. They may be like the girl on the bus. They may be the girl that, you know, has a Saturday job doing your hair. And they're the invisible girls and women that were in your school, in your class, that you lose touch with. And she brings such a great dignity to that and respect to that role.
This film takes a real turn, and I think if you're going to watch it, you need to know that it's going to take this turn. We're not giving anything away, but when COVID-19 becomes a part of the story, it is very difficult to watch what's going on in the care home.
Yeah, it is. And I just think this is such a tough topic to tackle. And, you know, it hasn't been 2 years since we've been in the middle of this ourselves, and we haven't had much time to process it, I think. And I was even thinking, you know, considering it took like Russell T Davies a long, long time, 20 years or more to tackle, you know, his own history with like the AIDS crisis when he wrote It's a Sin. Like, we're right still on top of this. We're not actually out of this yet. Yeah. So I'm wondering, if viewers will give this a miss because it's far too soon and it feels like a heavy, heavy topic that has leaked from the news into our dramas, and they want escapism and they don't want their, you know, this to be infecting their downtime as well. So I do wonder, will it attract an audience?
But having said, you know, it's a difficult watch. Mm. It kind of strikes me that it's something that you should watch and look at some of the ideas in it.
It's a very important a very important piece of work. I think if you can stomach the second and third act, it's just hugely powerful. And the way it's shot, it's shot like a horror film.
Looks like Contagion, like one of those big pandemic diseases.
It really
does.
It really does.
When films you see, at time.
There is a point where she's left alone for 24 hours and basically is fighting for, you know, a patient's life, really. And she isn't this, it's like the final girl trope in horror films, but she isn't this plucky heroine. She's not even a doctor. Oh. She's not a nurse. She's just an ordinary person.
Okay, let's move on. That's 9 o'clock tomorrow on Channel 4. Let's move on to the morning show. This is the big first season, and met by a lot of people. I didn't see it at the time, and then I was trying to catch up on it. You kind of need to know the setup going into this. Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon kind of sparring anchors on the morning show.
They are. And basically they have been, Reese Witherspoon's character was plucked from local news obscurity when Mitch Kessler, who's played by Steve Carell, was fired after several sexual misconduct allegations were made against him. So he leaves
the morning
show.
Very much of the time back in 2019.
It was kind of like a retelling of the Matt Lauer Me NBC. Too scandal. Yeah, and also the Roger Ailes, the Fox scandal, and also Harvey Weinstein, of course. But so Reese Witherspoon plays Bradley Jackson, and she's just very down-home, southern, hard news. She's into hard news and local stories, and Jennifer Aniston is the very polished Alex Levy, and she's this kind of ice queen off camera but very warm on camera, and is this becomes this feminist icon in the new series because of what's transpired.
They had to get COVID-19 into this as well.
No, they shoehorned it.
I was going to say, I saw The Empty Streets of New York, big, you know. That's nothing got to do with anything in the drama here except you're showing us where it's set. Maybe it has later on.
It does later on. There is a character called Daniel, who's another one of the team in the morning show, and he actually goes to Wuhan to report about COVID, but they don't want to hear about it. They think it's no news and it's not for morning television. And then you see the kind of what happens as the pandemic evolves. But also, it doesn't ring very true when you see, you know, Reese Witherspoon trying to act shocked about social distancing. It just, it feels very fake.
Yeah.
But I have to say, the Morning Show is one of the most enjoyable dramas. It's very glossy.
Fun.
It's like a bit of broadcast news in there, which I love. One of my favourite films ever. It's about grown-ups doing their jobs, which I always enjoy watching.
Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston, undoubtedly brilliant. We have to mention Billy Crudup. I think his character has been kind of beefed up for season 2.
He has. He won a surprise Emmy last year for Outstanding Supporting Actor as the eccentric executive Corey Ellison, and they brought him back in a meatier kind of role, and he still is the straw that stirs the drink, but he loves moving those characters around like chess pieces. But he can't afford to be so cavalier this season because the executives are watching him, and one of the new studio heads is played by Holland Taylor, and their scenes together are electric. But I have to say that the whole, for me, it's Jennifer Aniston. It's all about her because it gives her something to do, and this is the character she was definitely born to play.
Season 1 of Season 2 makes me want to go right back and watch all of Season 1. Okay, so lots to think about there. Jen Gannon telling us about Kin, RT1, 9:30 this Sunday, Episode 2. Episode 1 still on the RTE player. Help on Channel 4 tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Be prepared for a harrowing watch if you go there. And The Morning Show returns to Apple TV this Friday.
What were Cain's last words?
Rosebud.
What were the last words he said on Earth?
I think it would be fun to run a newspaper.
You're right, Mr. Thatcher. I did lose $1 million last year. I expect to lose $1 million this year.
Careful, Charles.
I expect to lose $1 million next year.
Pull your muffler around your neck, Charles.
You know, Mr. Thatcher, at the rate of $1 million a year, I'll have to close this place in 60 years.
Hello, Jedediah.
Here's a man that could have been president.
Hello, Charlie.
Who was as loved and hated.
I didn't know we were speaking.
And as talked about as any man in our time.
Sure we're speaking, Jedediah.
It isn't enough to tell us what a man did.
You're fired.
You've got to tell us who he was.
I'm Charles Foster Kane!
Rosebud, the last words of Charles Foster Kane, as played by Orson Welles in Citizen Kane, the film which is 80 years old, is for many the greatest film ever made. Why? Well, lots of reasons, but partly because of the way it tells the story of Cain using flashbacks. And as we heard, there are multiple narrators telling the same story from different points of view. Much of the innovation in Citizen Kane was down to its director, the main actor as well, Orson Welles, but also its cinematographer, Greg Toland. And here to talk to us about Toland's contribution to the film and his impact on generations of filmmakers is lecturer at the National Film School, Stephen Benedict. I mean, if we talk about photography, people say, oh, the photography in this film is absolutely brilliant. They usually mean it looks gorgeous. It looks great. It's very pretty or very stylish.
Yeah, but it's cinematography is more than that. In actual fact, if we're talking about photography, it comes from the Greek. The Greek term means to write with light, but cinematography is different. It's to move, to write with movement. And that's why we call them motion pictures. Okay. And so cinematography is more than just being pretty. It's where you put the camera. It's what lens you put on the camera, composing the shot, racking focus from foreground to background.
Now, let's just talk a little bit about focus, because I suppose, if in simple terms, the cinematographer will decide, let's focus on this bit at the back of the room, if you like, and the front of the room is slightly blurry.
Yeah.
Or let's pull the focus out and now we can focus at the front of the room and the back of the room is slightly blurry. But in the case of Toland in particular, we're talking about something else, a thing called deep focus. What is that?
Yeah, deep focus is where everything is in focus at the same time. And that's a really, really tricky proposition. It's easier to rack focus than it is to keep everything in deep focus. In order to do deep focus, you have to have a lot of light. And the thing was, Toland likes to experiment, he liked to take the difficult path, and Orson Welles didn't want a lot of light in Citizen Kane. He wanted this character of Kane to be constantly in the shadows, to be mysterious and enigmatic, and who was he? And so what Toland needed to do was to master very, very low levels of light and then keep everything in focus, which is really, really, really hard. And that sort of keys into the theme of the story, because it's all about the quest for what is the truth, what is Rosebud, but what is Rosebud and who was Charles Foster Kane?
So Toland gave us this idea of deep focus. Now, he didn't invent it, but it was just the fact that he was doing it with so little light that was so innovative. Yeah,
that's correct.
Now, so how did that begin to affect further down into the generations of cinema,
well,
filmmakers?
Yeah, well, if we can pick off a couple of films, for example, we look at maybe, say, The Social Network, directed by David Fincher. And, you know, it's appropriate, I think, because Fincher made Mank last year.
Yeah, about the making of Citizen Kane.
Yeah, and Fincher is very, very well known for prefers to shoot in very, very low levels of light. But one of the things that Toland did really, really well was he moving the camera, constantly moving the camera through the rooms in Citizen Kane. And there's a clip that I think we have from The Social Network. And this is the scene where Mark Zuckerberg is setting up Face Smash,
as it was called at
the
time.
Yes, unfortunately.
Yeah. And so let's listen to it first and then you'll tell us what's actually happening in terms of what we're looking at as this scene is going on.
Sure.
I'm not going to do the farm animals, but I like the idea of comparing two people together. It gives the whole thing a very Turing feel, since people's ratings of the pictures will be more implicit than, say, choosing a number to represent each person's hotness like they do on hotornot.com. The first thing we're going to need is a lot of pictures. Unfortunately, Harvard doesn't keep a public centralized Facebook, so I'm going to have to get all the images from the individual houses that people are in. Let the hacking begin.
Mark Zuckerberg, not Mark Zuckerberg there. That is the character of Mark Zuckerberg.
Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah, Jesse Eisenberg. That's what I'm trying to think about. In The Social Network there, playing Mark Zuckerberg and Face Smash. Mm. Now, Greg, and I'm going to call you Greg Toland, Stephen Benedict.
I wish.
Yeah. What is happening in terms of focus, pulling or deep focus, or what's happening
there? In this sequence, it's very, very clever, because what is happening in terms of the story is Mark Zuckerberg is hacking into the homepages of the houses across Harvard campus. And throughout the sequence, the camera does something similar, because it's constantly moving from one space into another space. We're constantly seeing through windows and doors and hallways. And throughout the rest of the film, you will notice that David Fincher's camera will move through walls. I mean, he was able to do that digitally. And so that's what Toland was doing in a pre-digital age. So he's taking the idea of the movement through from one space to another space. And so, you know, it's in keeping with The Social Network, because actually The Social Network
is a remake of Citizen Kane. In that, we're talking about a very wealthy young man, or a man who becomes very wealthy, and we're in the world of media, essentially.
Exactly, the same thing.
Yeah, right. Let's go away there, because that's a biopic as well, in the way that Citizen Kane is, if you like. Crime drama now, Heat with Robert De Niro. We're going to listen to a clip late in the film. Just give us the setup here. There's a phone call involved.
Yeah, okay. The robbery's happened. The robbery failed. There's a huge gun battle, and a lot of the characters, a lot of the gangsters were injured. And Robert De Niro is about to make his getaway. He's in the car with Amy Brenneman, and he's on the highway heading for the airport, but he can't help himself. He makes a phone call.
So he makes a phone call. Let's listen to the phone call. We'll talk about the visuals after.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's me.
Plane's in the air now. We ran out of time. On the driver's end, I still can't find nobody, so that's in the trust. One other thing. You asked, so I gotta tell you. The guy you wanted checked into the Hotel Marquis under Jameson, if you still give a shit. Which I figured you wouldn't.
You figured right.
So long, brother. You take it easy. You're home free.
Take it easy.
Robert De Niro there in the scene from Heat, and Stephen Benedict speaking to us about cinematography the same. So we need to talk about, you hear cars whooshing past.
That's right, we're on the freeway.
We're on, and that car swishing past in terms of our experience is a kind of a parallel to what's happening visually, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, the reason why I'm linking this back to Citizen Kane is because Greg Toland broke one of the rules, which is actually filming directly into lights. The danger of shooting into directly into a light is they're going to flare the lens.
And back, so everything becomes all...
It becomes...
It's like the light shining in your face. You can't see at all.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's quite common now. You see it in commercials to the nth degree, so much so that if they don't do it on set, they have an app to pop in a flare at a lens. I think it's really, really boring. Once upon a time, it used to be considered to be a sign of incompetence on the director. But when Greg Toland was shooting into the light, he was actually making sure that the flare, the lens didn't flare. But in this scene... In Heat, it's the only scene in the entire movie where they flare the lens. And it's not a mistake, it's deliberate. Because when Toland was using the light, he was using it expressively to convey an emotion. And in this scene, when we're looking at De Niro, we see the lights from the cars behind him, and suddenly they start to flare the lens. And as far as I'm concerned, that light is to express his emotional state, because he's itching. He can't help himself. He wants to track down this guy, Wayne Grow, and kill him. And the lens flare is this temptation. And so suddenly when he decides to go off and kill him, within seconds of this flaring of the lens, he's off on the exit ramp and off going down to hunt him down.
And even obviously you understand the technicalities of what's happening there with the flaring of the lens and the light, et cetera, et cetera. But for the viewer who mightn't have that technical knowledge, is the emotional journey, you don't know why you're being brought on the emotional journey, but clever cinematography or good cinematography will bring you on that journey.
Yeah, I think the best way to describe the great cinematographers is they show us things that aren't there. It's poetic. Mm. They suggest something. They convey an emotion. Light is expressive. They use light expressively. They use framing to suggest foreground, midground and background as someone who's going to dominate the frame in the foreground and someone who's diminished in the background. Citizen Kane is full of it. Orson Welles loved doing that sort of stuff.
Just going back to that then, you talk about showing us things that aren't there, but in that idea of deep focus, which is where you see everything.
Yeah.
So how are we seeing what's not there as well?
Well, here's the thing, because it's the space between the... Now, this is going to be a little bit
technical, okay.
Well, not technical. It's the space between the background that we're looking at in the background and looking at the foreground. You compare and contrast. In Citizen Kane, there's a scene where the young boy, Charles Foster Kane, is given up for adoption. And we see him outside in the background playing in the snow. And in the foreground, his parents in the house are signing the contract. It's the little boy. And in the foreground, he got the big contract. So the boy is being relegated. Right. So when we see deep focus, it's the comparing and contrasting.
This is, I suppose, if you look at Orson Welles and his theatre background, it's
absolutely.
When you're sitting in a theatre, you do deep focus yourself without knowing you're doing it as you look at the stage. Let's move on to the third film then. Hardly surprising that Martin Scorsese should have found something in Citizen Kane that he might use in his own films, because he's constantly referred to it as the greatest film and the huge influence on him. You're talking about Goodfellas.
Mm. Yeah, now I think we're talking about camera movement, as I was saying. Mm. Toland used a lot of camera movement in Citizen Kane. And I think when we mention Goodfellas and camera movement, we all think of the Copacabana scene. That's not the scene I'm talking about. Although the Copacabana scene is fantastic, because that isn't just about fancy pants camera movement. It's all about seduction. Henry is seducing Karen. And it's also the movie is seducing the audience, because it's really saying to us, don't you want to live like this guy? Mm. Never have to wait online in a nightclub. But the sequence that we've chosen here is from the end of Goodfellas, and it's the courtroom, the final scene in the courtroom.
And again, I think if you listen carefully to this, you'll get a sense almost of this court scene happening in the background as Henry, the character, is talking directly to us.
That's
which
correct.
Is what he does as the narrator.
Yeah.
Anything I wanted was a phone call away.
three cars, the keys to a dozen hideout flats all over the city. I'd bet 20, 30 grand over a weekend, and then I'd either blow the winnings in a week or go to the Sharks to pay back the bookies.
Didn't matter. Didn't mean anything. When I was broke, I would go out and rob some more. We ran everything. We paid off cops, we paid off lawyers, we paid off judges. Everybody had their hands out. Everything was for the taking. And now it's all over.
And that's Ray Liotta as Henry in the closing scenes there from Goodfellas. Now, what's happening as that? Because it sounds as if he's just telling something might be going on in his head, but there's a lot more than that, Stephen.
It needs a little bit of context. The movie begins with Henry telling us, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. And that suggested to us that this movie is going to be a memoir. And it is, until a point, until Henry is arrested. And then he cops a plea bargain to avoid prison. And it's at this point that we realise that Henry's narration isn't a memoir, but a testimony, because suddenly we see him in court on the stand. And that's a massive shift, because until then, the voiceover was actually being hidden from us because we didn't see him in court. And so he's detailing to the prosecutors how the mafia is structured. And then there's another huge shift, because as you said, he suddenly turns to the camera and starts talking to the camera. Now, breaking the fourth wall isn't a big deal, but the point is to say to you, where do you put the camera? And in this scene, the camera is in the jury box. So he's addressing the jury, but he's talking to us because we are the jury and we are judging him. And then another huge shift, he gets up out of the witness box and he starts walking across the court, the floor. The camera moves with him and he's constantly talking to the camera. As he says, we paid off lawyers, we paid off judges, we paid off cops. And at that point,
And of course, because the camera's looking, he's looking at us down the camera, we're complicit in all of that.
Yeah, but that's the entire idea, because Scorsese's making that point. And this is what I'm saying to you. It shows you something that isn't there. So at the end, he's talking to the gallery. He's talking to the public and he's explaining to the public how much the mafia has infiltrated and corrupted public life.
Yeah, so a little bit more than to cinematography than pretty pictures.
That's what I'm saying. That's what we were saying.
Is that kind of what you're telling
me, Steve? Yeah, it's to show what's not there.
Give me a couple of other big names apart from Toland that you would say, if it comes to cinematography, these are your people.
Well, contemporary would say Roger Deakins, Emmanuel Lubezki, who works with Alfonso Cuarón quite a lot. Roger Deakins works with the Coen brothers. I think one of the greatest cinematographers was a guy called Michael Ballhaus, who worked repeatedly with Scorsese. He worked on also with Mike Nichols on a great rom-com picture from the 1980s, an underrated rom-com called Working Girl. So those would be three, I think.
All right. And lots to be thinking about there and looking at when we're watching those films. Thanks so much, Stephen Benedict, particularly on cinematography, and Greg Toland.